ask you the question, what day is today? Perhaps that's a loaded question, isn't it? Some may say, well, it's Melanie's birthday, but that might not be the first answer that most of us would give. But the first answer for many would likely be that it's Christmas. And yes, December 25th is the day that is known as Christmas. And some would go as far as to say that today is the day that Jesus was born. And to that I would ask, how do you know that? And we can talk more about that later. But to every single Christian, the answer, first and foremost, should be that this is the first day of the week and is also referred to as the Lord's Day. That this Sunday, as we do every Sunday, is the day that we memorialize, and we already have just moments ago, the specific historic event from the life of Christ that we were told in God's Word to observe, which of course is Christ's death on the cross. However, regardless of the coincidence of Christmas falling on a Sunday this year, more people will likely attend worship services today more than any other time of the year. Numerous people around the world are with their families and exchanging gifts and spending time with one another. And on the surface alone, I think that is something to be thankful for, at least on surface level, that some are hearing a Bible message today where maybe that's not often the case the rest of the year. And I'm thankful that we still have a desire to be with loved ones and exchange gifts with each other. And so there's still a sliver of hope for mankind, isn't there? And I know everyone has their own opinions or their own views on Christmas. We can fall on either side of the coin on that, and I respect that as well. My wife's parents don't observe Christmas at all, and I appreciate their reasons why. And my family does observe Christmas, at least in regards to spending time with one another, exchanging gifts, having a tree and lights and all the rest, and of course eating good food. But that's as far as it goes for us as well. It doesn't even matter what day we do that on. In fact, Laura, Evelyn, and I had our version of it yesterday morning, because Sundays are just flat out crazy to begin with. Why would we want to throw everything else into it that goes with Christmas? And so that has already been done for us. But after thinking about it and learning a couple of other Christian preachers' viewpoints, of whom I both trust and respect, I've got to ask myself and other Christians, do we tend to be uptight about the birth of Jesus? And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be in the cards this morning for the PowerPoint. We'll get it fixed for tonight. But don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that we need to throw a birthday party for Jesus, as I've heard other places may do that. Laura's in a mother's group where they actually have some ladies there that they bake birthday cakes for Jesus and have celebrations in that way. I'm not to that level of things here. I don't think that we have the authority to do those kind of things or anything to that extent. I firmly believe there's no possible way that we can even know the exact day of his birth, as we've been talking about even in our class this morning. And I would suggest that it's not even around the time of December 25th. And much of what is believed is hinged around the verse of Luke chapter 2 and verse 8, talking about the shepherds tending their flock, that most likely they wouldn't be doing that in the winter time. And so many believe that December 25th and winter would not be the time of year that Jesus was born in the first place. It was determined by man, and there is no evidence to be found. As we talked to the kids this morning, there was no birth certificate found of Jesus that stated the day that he was born. There was no other evidence to prove of when he was born, and it has just been a decision made by man, and more or less, from what I understand, picked to combat paganism that happened around that time, that there was pagan festivals surrounding that time of December, the later half of December. And so all of that being the case, when I think about my years of growing up and attending worship services and hearing services, I still come away with this question of, why haven't I heard many lessons, really, if any, because I can't really remember any growing up or even in my adult life, on the birth of Jesus. We may teach our little ones about the birth of Jesus, and because it's a story about a baby, and babies tend to like other babies, and so that's an easy lesson to teach, and we'll talk about baby Moses and baby. But why can't I really recall ever really hearing a sermon about Christ's birth? In my preparation, I found a great quote from one of my former professors from Florida College, Brother Dwayne Moyer, and he happens to preach in Alabama now. But in this piece that he wrote, I believe he captures the reason that why we should be open to talking about the birth of Jesus, even around Christmas time. As crazy as that may be to our psyche or what we've grown up in thinking, why should we talk about Jesus' birth even today? And let's read what Brother Moyer said. He writes, "At this time of year, some people who may rarely otherwise do so will think a little bit about Jesus. There are many errors that float around concerning Jesus at this time, but Christians should seize upon the opportunities to teach the truth. If people take this time to think a little about Jesus' birth, then let's teach the truth about it. While it is unlikely that Jesus was born on December 25th, the truth is that he was born at some time, and the implications of his birth are far greater than any particular time of the year. If they are willing to do so during this season, why not take people to the Scriptures and let them see the truth of what his birth means? He says, truth in its purest form will always debunk the errors that find their way into culture. Yet our goal is not just to debunk errors. Our goal is to get people to understand what really happened so that they can appreciate what it means for their salvation." Think about that. And let's consider that last statement again, that truth in its purest form will always debunk the errors that find their way into culture, yet our goal is not just to debunk errors. Our goal is to get people to understand what really happened so that they can appreciate what it means for their salvation. But perhaps we have been operating with the MO of what Brother Moyer says should not be our goal. And we just live our lives as Christians and live as a Bible student to just debunk errors instead of really looking for the opportunity to share and teach the truth. That we take on maybe the form of a debater instead of one of a teacher. That we try to just prove someone wrong instead of trying to share with them what the gospel truth message is. And maybe we think there is a fine line, but there's a stark difference in the two. And we need to be sure that we are on the side of looking for the opportunity to teach and not the opportunity to just get into a heated debate, as quite frankly has been the history of the church in the past. And that's not right. And so we need to be asking ourselves, what is my goal in this? Because if my goal is to just debunk errors and win debates, my attitude is going to reflect that. People are going to be able to read that a mile away. You're just trying to prove me wrong. You're just trying to get into an argument. But if my goal is to share with them what the meaning of all of this is in regards to their salvation, my attitude is going to look a lot different, isn't it? It's going to be in the mode of a teacher, of one who is more caring and thoughtful and trying to be more thought-provoking and having that person think more seriously about where they are in comparison to what the gospel says. And as Brother Moyer said, we need to seize upon the opportunities to teach. I wholeheartedly believe that that is the case. And what better time of year to have an opportunity when the world is celebrating the birth of Jesus to be able to find an opportunity to talk about Jesus when the world is talking about him. It doesn't mean that we need to celebrate Christmas the way that the world does, that we need to have a birthday party for Jesus or anything else. But why do we shut down the opportunity to talk about him? And yes, to even talk specifically about his birth. And so we're going to talk about that this morning. And certainly it's true that there is more said about Jesus as an adult than there was as a baby or as a young boy. And it's also true that we do need to put a great emphasis on the cross and on the resurrection of our Savior. And I think we do that very well. And we do that every Sunday. However, the fact remains that if Jesus never came to earth, think about these facts. If Jesus never came to earth, he never would have turned heads to as a 12-year-old at the temple, impressing others with his knowledge. He never would have had apostles and other disciples to follow him. He never would have preached the Sermon on the Mount or any other amazing lessons or parables. He never would have walked on water, calmed the sea, fed the multitudes, raised Lazarus, or performed any number of miracles. And if Jesus never came to earth, above all, he never would have endured the torture of the cross and rise again on the third day. So let me ask you, how important is the birth of Jesus? It's absolutely critical to the faith of a Christian. It is absolutely vital. Because if Jesus never came to earth to be born in like manner as you and I, and to live in flesh and blood, there would be no meaningful reason for us to even be gathered together this morning. No purpose whatsoever. Simply put, Jesus had to be born in order to die and to raise up to life again. And therefore, I believe there is every reason that we should talk about the birth of Jesus. And it really should have no bearing on what day of the year it falls on, that we can talk about the birth of Jesus any day of the week, any Sunday on the calendar. And that's because we are thankful that he came, period. So let's talk about the true story of Christ's birth, and let's just all understand, as I hope we're already getting the picture, this isn't just a cute little Christmas story or anything like that, but this is really a Christ story. And there's no more logical place to start than with the actual story of his birth, right? Well, maybe not. Maybe it goes before that, as I believe it truly does, that the story of Jesus really begins far before being away in a manger, before his arrival, because he was always expected. And so if you're taking notes, the first point is before the manger, that he was in the beginning. And when we say the beginning, he was in the very beginning. Before the concept of time from man's standards, that he was in the beginning. In John chapter 1, I accidentally fibbed to you this morning, you may want to turn to some of these passages, but in John chapter 1, we're told just how much Jesus was in the beginning with God. And specifically in verse 1, we read, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And you notice that word is capitalized. That's a capital W. And there's a reason for that. Because then verse 2, "He was in the beginning with God." Then skip down as he gives a full description of Jesus and who he is and who he was. Verse 14, "And the Word," capital W again, "became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." And so what do we see there? That Jesus always was before he ever even was flesh and blood. That there was always a reason for Jesus. There was always an understanding of Jesus, if not always understood by man. God always knew Jesus. Jesus was always there. Jesus was always present. And so we see that this was foretold even far beyond the gospel record accounts of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, that Jesus was always expected. And we see that the specific detail of how he would be born was foretold in the Old Testament. In Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, we're told of the virgin birth of Jesus. And it was the very concern of Mary, the mother of Jesus, in Luke chapter 1 and verses 34 and 35, that she was concerned about the fact of, "Angel, how am I supposed to have a baby when I'm a virgin? How am I supposed to be pregnant without the natural process of getting pregnant?" And the angel spelled that out for her. He told her what would happen. And yet we see that very fact of how it happened is what was foretold centuries before in the prophecy of Isaiah. And not only that he would be born of a virgin, but there where he was born was also foretold, that this little bitty, seemingly insignificant town of Bethlehem would be the birthplace of Jesus. And we're told that all the way back, again, in the Old Testament of Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. We know that Bethlehem is significant from the standpoint of it was also the hometown of King David. But other than that, there's really no special thing about Bethlehem. It was a small town, and from my understanding, it is still a small town today. But think about the great detail of even being foretold hundreds of years before the event that Micah, told by God, would reveal where this ruler would be born, as he puts it, in the small town of Bethlehem. And from not only Micah's prophecy, but others, we're told that Jesus was always to be king. Not only that he was expected, that he was going to be born of a virgin, but that he was always to be king. And so that is one among many roles and titles. Turn with me, if you would, to Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9. And this is a passage that is oftentimes read around this time of year, because it is a passage that truly reflects the expectation of Jesus, and it is a passage that should be read all throughout the year as we think about who this Jesus is. In Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, we're told, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." And when we think about the prophecy of Isaiah likely taking place over 700 years prior to the actual arrival of Jesus, that puts a little more weight on things, doesn't it? I mean, think about this. If I were to tell you something in detail, as Isaiah has done here, and this wouldn't be the only place that he foretells the coming of Jesus, but if I told you great detail of something coming up in the future that you would have no notion about, no idea of otherwise, and then come to find out it comes exactly as I told you it would be, that'd be something else, wouldn't it? You'd be interested to know what else I knew. And if we were gambling people, you'd probably ask me for the lotto numbers too, but I know you're better than that, and I am too, and we're not going to do those things. But you would want to know what else I knew. And that's the draw of the prophets. That's the draw of the Bible, to see, okay, all of this stuff was foretold, and then we see, sure enough, it happened exactly the way God had prophesied through his prophets. Tell me more. Tell me more about this Jesus. Tell me more about what I have to do with him and what's in this for me. And so you would want to know what else is known. But even with prophecies from centuries before and Christ's own prophecies, we see that it often went against the expectations of men. That even with these prophecies, men still got confused about Jesus. And ironically enough, men and women are still confused about Jesus today. That even Jesus' disciples, as we can read in Acts chapter 1, verses 6 through 7, which is just moments before his ascension back to the Father in heaven, that they were asking him about the establishment of his kingdom, and they were asking it in a very physical way, wanting to know how he would establish his kingdom in Israel, to restore it. And you would think that after a few years with Jesus that they would get this through their heads, but yet even they were still confused about these things. And yet still today, people are confused as to what Christ is actually going to do and what he has already done and how his kingdom works or how his kingdom will work. But let me tell you this morning that his kingdom is here right now. And we are part of that kingdom as the church. That this is the iteration, this is the way that God wanted his kingdom to establish, that Jesus had laid the groundwork for it, had told Peter and the other apostles that it would be founded on him and on the basis of their faith, that they would be the building blocks for building up this kingdom. And we are kingdom citizens as Christians belonging to Christ who look forward to be part of that heavenly kingdom. And so to help guide souls down that path, we need to be led by someone, don't we? And of course, that was the purpose of Jesus as well, to have someone to essentially pattern our lives after. And per God's plan, Christ was always to be Emmanuel. And Emmanuel simply means God with us. And of course, we know God has always been with us as far as he created the world, and he has always been among us and all the rest. But he was to come down to us in a very physical way, as was foretold again in Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14. And in Matthew chapter 1, if you go back to that passage that I told you to look at, Matthew chapter 1, which actually happens to reference back to the Old Testament and the prophets. Matthew chapter 1 and verse 22. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet: "Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which means God with us. That there is no question that God has always been present, as we've said, and active in the lives of men, but he always intended to send Jesus to physically be Emmanuel, to be God with us. And so as we continue, that we see God is planning all of this out, and he has planned this out to perfection and far in advance. This was not just a fly-by-night plan that he came up with. But perhaps as we've heard the story and read the story and consider these things and we see how Jesus was born, maybe we're left with the question, here is main point number two, asking a question: is this really God's will for it to happen this way? Did God really mean for it to be that Jesus was born in a manger, that he was born in this insignificant way, seemingly by the standards of men, that he was born in this basically a stable? That's what God's will was for Jesus, his own son? You know, I'm going to take a wild guess here that when we begin to read about the story of Jesus in Matthew, that maybe we don't necessarily read verses 1 through 18 very often. Or if we do, we glaze through it very quickly, glance through it and say, okay, bunch of names, got it, that's genealogy, let's get to the good stuff, let's get to the story of his birth. Well, let me tell you, there's some good stuff in verses 1 through 18. You might say, well, it's just a bunch of names. But think about some of the names that we read of here, because when it comes down to it, Jesus had quite the family tree. In Matthew chapter 1 and verses 1 through 18, while we don't have time to read through the entire list, let's just hit a few of the highlights. Beginning in verse 1, the book of the genealogy, and already people go, oh, genealogies, because we know them from the Old Testament. But this is the genealogy of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Already our ears should perk up. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. And then you skip down to verse 5, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king, and David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph. And so, while we don't have time to break down this entire list and consider the overall magnitude, we do see some very recognizable names here just right off, don't we? Right from the very first verse. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Rahab. Rahab. You mean Rahab the harlot? And the one whose profession was to be a woman of the night and to do these sinful things. You mean she is in the genealogy of Jesus? I mean, you may have been on board for the first several names that we read, but then you get to Rahab, and as the Bible so often, this is one case in which it doesn't, but even in Hebrews, talking about the hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, how does the Hebrew writer record her name? Rahab the harlot, or Rahab the prostitute. And yet here she is in the lineage of Jesus. Oh, is this a misprint? Did God get it wrong that somehow she found her way in the lineage of Jesus and that this is just a big scandal? Or what's the story here? We may have been on board with all these names. And then we see someone like Ruth, who wasn't even an Israelite. And yet Jesus was an Israelite. Jesus was a Jew. And then, of course, we see another very familiar and prominent name, of course, David, the king, the great king of Israel. And that name would stop everyone in their tracks. And we get back on board, at least for that one, and say, okay, this is somebody who is important. There's King David, a man who is well respected. But yet, Jesus would ultimately overshadow even King David, as Matthew would indicate in Matthew 22 and verses 41 through 46. So what do we learn from this genealogy? And just this crash course look at this genealogy of all of these people in Jesus' family tree, even someone like Rahab being found in it. I think, for one, God always planned this. For his son to be of the line of David and of Abraham, and yes, even Rahab the harlot, that in this lineage alone, God is showing that all of these people, as imperfect as all of them are, not just Rahab, but as imperfect as all of them are, that no one is too imperfect for Jesus to have relation with, or to be related to, or to be involved with, let alone to be born into such a family as this. And that while they were imperfect, they certainly are not deity. But I think another thing that we gain from Matthew chapter 1 and other accounts of his parents, that Mary and Joseph were special. They weren't deity, but they were special people. They were picked for a reason. They had remained pure prior to their official marriage, and they valued that, as we can tell from the context of Matthew 1 and Luke 1. We read in Matthew 1:19 that Joseph was a just man and unwilling to put her, Mary, to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. I mean, I think we could take a whole lot from just this passage in Matthew, looking at the character of both Joseph and Mary, considering that Joseph was thoughtful not only of his situation, but of Mary's reputation and of her future. And while he didn't know the entire story just yet, we see that he was not a harsh or brash man, that he was not closed-minded either and didn't disregard the words of the angel, and he obeyed, as we read later in verse 24 of that text. And then Mary, too, didn't know exactly what to think about this telling of this virgin birth. And Luke 1:30 would even say that she was greatly troubled, as the angel would encourage her and tell her to not be afraid. And once Mary had her questions asked and answered about the divine logistics of all this, we read in Luke chapter 1 and verse 38, and let's just turn there right quick, unfortunately not having this on the screen slowing us down a little bit, but Luke chapter 1 and verse 38, what is said of Mary? Once she gets all of these answers, as the angel tells her in verse 37, for nothing will be impossible with God. There's so much weight in that verse beyond what's being spoken of here. But in verse 38, Mary said, behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. And the angel departed from her. And we know that she would have a song of praise in verses 46 through 55 after visiting Elizabeth, who was pregnant at that time with John the Baptist. But we understand that Mary had, as we like to say, a servant's heart, a servant's attitude, that was her mindset. And so there is something special about her and about Joseph, and that needs to be recognized. While we shy away from ever referring to Mary as deity, which we should, we cannot ignore the fact that she was a true servant of God, and I have every belief that she and Joseph were chosen for a reason. Why wouldn't God choose Mary to be the mother of Jesus after this kind of attitude, after this kind of reaction in verse 38? And that while we don't have to elevate her to deity, we can be thankful for her incredible example, and we can follow her example in that way, that we can say, I want to be a servant like her. Because let's not be mistaken here, and this is the next point, that this situation that Mary and Joseph find themselves in is nothing short of a very difficult situation. What a challenging situation to be put in. And when we think about the story of Job, and no doubt extremely challenging what he went through and everything else, and on through the Gospels and through Scripture, we see people pitted up against their greatest fears or terrible situations or challenging situations. And this is one very challenging situation. There is the song Silent Night that is sung around this time of year. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright. Really? Was it really all that calm for Mary and Joseph and Jesus? Was it really all that bright? Maybe in a spiritual sense, yes, but physically, in the moment of what they were going through, this was terrifying. This was a very scary and difficult situation as they find themselves in. Another Christian preacher whom I respect, Brother Shane Scott, who preaches down in Florida, he wrote about the birth of Jesus, and he said that it was not all calm and bright. And let me read what he had to say about this. This is a lengthy excerpt, but I think it's very helpful for us considering the context of this lesson. But he says, calm and bright are the last two words I would use to depict the birth of Jesus in the Gospels. How calm could Bethlehem have been when Jews from all over Palestine were pouring in for a census commanded by the emperor, as we read in Luke chapter 2 and verses 4 and 5. Bethlehem was a small town back then, as it is today. To be inundated with so many travelers would have created lots of chaos and confusion in a small village, the very picture drawn for us in Luke chapter 2, a town overbooked with visitors. Therefore, where Mary and Joseph found themselves giving birth to Jesus. How calm do you think Joseph and Mary would have been traveling the 90 miles from Nazareth to Bethlehem so late into her pregnancy? What a difficult journey that must have been. And remember, they had to do it on foot or horseback. And once they got into the little village, there was no place to stay. Though the text does not say so, the reference to a manger indicates they had to bed down where animals were kept, possibly a stable. And in those crude accommodations, Mary went into labor. What a nerve-wracking way this must have been to end the long trip. I have to wonder how Mary and Joseph would react if they knew centuries later he would be singing, or we would be singing, about how calm and bright that night was. It was a painful, stressful, busy night for that family. Now, of course, as for any birth, it is a joyous occasion when the baby is delivered. But is it calm in the moments prior? Just ask any mother. You tell me what they say. No way. How would it be any different for Mary? All was not calm and bright in that moment. And with all of the other surrounding events of that time, it is a recipe for a very stressful situation. And so you think about the events surrounding the birth of Jesus and the stress and the fear that was probably likely had by both Mary and Joseph, that Jesus came into the world in a stressful situation and he left the world in a stressful situation, but yet his coming and his going was all to create peace, was to create hope for mankind, was to provide salvation. And so while Mary and Joseph may not have grasped the total gravity of the situation, this certainly would be a joyful moment for them, but not all was calm and bright in this very moment. But all of the elements that Brother Scott mentioned here in this article, we can't ignore those facts. We cannot allow a Christmas carol to determine what the situation was in the moment of Jesus' birth. That the Gospels tell us what it really was like and the surrounding context, and we have to understand this was not a picture-perfect situation. However, as it may not have been picture perfect, it was perfect timing. Or as Paul would later say in Galatians chapter 4, that it was the fullness of time. In Galatians chapter 4 and verses 4 and 5, we read, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons." That Jesus didn't just come to earth for us to gather around a Christmas tree and exchange presents and everything else on this day, December 25th. But Jesus came to earth, as Paul says here, so that we might receive adoption as sons and, of course, as daughters. That's why Jesus came. Jesus and God want you here more than just on December 25th or Christmas Eve in a midnight mass or any other time. He wants you here every Sunday because that's what he told us to do. He said to remember my son every first day of the week. As often as you do this, remember Jesus. He didn't say that it was December 25th or Easter or whenever else is the tradition of man. But he says, I came because you can have a hope as an heir through God. That you could be adopted as a son. That while I sent my son to be born of a virgin, my only son, I did it so I could have more sons and daughters. That's the gravity of the birth of Jesus. That is the hope and the joy and the peace. Because there is not going to be ultimate peace on earth. It's not going to happen. But there can be peace for those who choose to follow Jesus. And that's what we need to consider. As we not only think about the birth of Jesus, that's not where the story ends, as it does for many people. That maybe this is the only time some people will have their Bibles open all year long, maybe Easter. But the Bible does not start and end right there in Matthew chapter 1 or Luke chapter 1. It goes on, and we have to consider as the, I don't remember him from my own memory, but the famed broadcaster Paul Harvey would say, Norm, I'm sure you know what it is, the rest of the story. And we have to think about the rest of the story of Jesus. That Jesus did grow up, as Luke would write in Luke chapter 2 and verse 40, that Jesus, the child, grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. That sets the table for the rest of the story of Jesus. That it did not end with him being a baby, did not end with him being in the temple as a 12-year-old, but it goes far beyond that. As we've already talked about, it goes far before even the birth of Jesus. And so we think about how the rest of the story unfolds. And let's just hit some of the main points here. That Jesus did go on to do the very thing that God the Father sent him to do. One of the kids in class this morning said it best, that God sent Jesus on a mission. And that's exactly what he did. That he related with mankind, living in like manner, but living a holy and sinless life. And that's the difference. Jesus would go on to select apostles and have other disciples who would live on to tell his story. They would relay to us that in addition to being born of a virgin, that Jesus would perform many miracles to show he truly was of God. We're also told that he taught in parables and spent time with people who were considered by society standards as low lives, although every person he lived among was with blame and was desperate for him, whether they knew it or not. And the same is true for you and I. Whether we realize it or not, we are most certainly desperate for Jesus. We're told that Jesus foretold his own death just as his birth was foretold. And then he would go on to fulfill his own prophecy of his death and go to the cross without putting up a fight and dying for the sins of the world. And we're told that the reason he did it was for each and every sinner, which is of course all of us. And because of his great love for us, that is what drove him to the cross, because he desired for us to be in heaven with him. And we're told that Jesus now sits at the right hand of the Father, and that he will come again, and that his coming will be like a thief in the night. In other words, we have no clue when he's coming back, but we know that he will come back, and we have to be ready for that day. Well, so many people plan their schedule around December 25th, around this Christmas holiday. It is imperative that we as Christians not only plan for the coming of Jesus, but that we share the rest of the story with the world and tell them, this is the day that you need to be prepared for. You need to get everything in line for the coming of Jesus. It is one thing to observe and be thankful for the birth of Jesus, and we should. And we shouldn't be afraid to talk about the birth of Jesus on Christmas Day, in the month of December, or in the middle of July, whenever. We need to be ready and willing to talk about Jesus, and whatever it takes to talk about Jesus, take these opportunities. We are handed a just prime opportunity in this time of year to be able to talk about Christ. And while it seems like the world is only thankful about Jesus this time of year, we need to show them we're thankful for him all year round, and you should too, and here is why. Because he came not only to live, but to die for you. And that's the rest of the story of Jesus. But the question that we have to leave you with this morning is, what's the rest of your story? And we all have a similar beginning, don't we? Congratulations, we've all been born. We all have a similar start, right? But the things that make us who we are throughout the course of our life are very different. We all have different backgrounds. And we have all different stories that make up our story. But we can all have a very similar end, or the same end, if we choose to follow Jesus. If we choose to obey the Lord by being baptized for the forgiveness of our sins, by appreciating not only his birth, but also the fact that he came here to die for you and for me, you will have the same end as any other person who faithfully serves God. And so the question is, are you ready to become a baptized Christian, a child of God this morning? And if you are already a Christian, but you found yourself struggling, perhaps not appreciating the story of Jesus, perhaps shying away from even talking about his birth and what he's done for you even since that point, then are you ready to address that today? What is the rest of your story? This was a story this morning about Christ. And the truth is, he wants to be part of your story. Not only does he want to be a part of it, he wants to be found on every page from today onward of your story. He wants to be the central, most figure of your life. But you have to make that decision. And you have to be at peace with that decision, because no one else can make that decision for you. So what is the rest of your story? Won't you answer that this morning while we stand and sing?